Now, protocol requires somebody to bang the table up there. Thank you. Thank you. Settle down. I'd like to introduce this week's speaker. It's a guy I went to school with, known him all my life. The only thing that's really new about him is that he has this rather strange new title. So on behalf of the speaker, I would like to say that I'm deeply grateful to be the J. Tuzo Wilson Professor of Geophysics. It's a case of being careful what you wish for. For some years, I have wished to be a geophysicist, and one day, it came true. So, you know, wish for good things. I moved my lab from the basement to the fifth floor 10 years ago. So it took 10 years before I became a geophysicist. So this is a geophysics talk. Okay? Thank you. The talk is called Consider the Icicle. Does anyone know where that comes from? Yes. Very good. It's a famous cook. It's the famous book about how to cook oysters called Consider the Oyster. But she stole it from somewhere else. Does anyone know where else it came from? The Bible. Consider the lilies of the field. They toil not, neither do they spin. I shall explain in this talk that icicles can, in fact, be made to spin under certain laboratory conditions. I am going to tell you everything and probably more than everything you wanted to know about icicles. And the real hero of this story is my former graduate student, Dr. Anthony Suhan Chen, who has very wisely decamped to the West Coast where their icicles are rare. We have also been ably assisted since last summer by an engineering undergraduate student by the name of Ken Lau, who's standing in the front row here. Ken Lau is responsible for turning the icicle machine from blue foam to pink foam. You may also have noticed that we were covered in the Toronto Star yesterday. This is a complete coincidence. In fact, the Toronto Star purchased that story from the Washington Post. And the Washington Post paid somebody to write that story. And then the Toronto Star just bought it from them. And they didn't even bother to change Fahrenheit to Celsius in the story. So I'm going to tell you about icicles, everything you ever wanted to know about icicles. And Anthony has written a large thesis on icicles, which is now on my webpage. And it's a masterpiece of prose. And I suggest that you read it just to understand what good writing is. Okay? So what is an icicle? Icicles are ice. Ice grows. When you take water at 0 degrees and you remove a certain amount of heat from it, you have to take some energy out of it called the latent heat. And if you manage to transfer that energy out of water, it will go from water at 0 degrees to ice at 0 degrees. So essentially, an icicle is a heat pump. In comes water at 0 degrees. Some heat is removed to the surrounding air, and it forms ice. The water actually runs down in a thin film over the whole surface of the icicle and drips off the end. So some of the heat, it turns out, is actually carried away by the drips that are falling off the end. But the rest of the heat has to get out through that thin film of flowing water into the surrounding cold air, which is usually at least minus 5 and maybe minus 10 degrees Celsius. And wherever the ice, wherever the water loses its heat in that way, then the ice will form. So the mystery is, how does that process produce these long, skinny things, which we're all so deeply familiar with? There is a very analogous thing that occurs in caves, stalactites, C for ceiling, they hang from the ceiling. Stalagmites, G for ground, those are the ones on the bottom. Stalactites superficially resemble icicles, and in fact, they're quite similar. There are some important differences, though. Water comes into the cave with a supersaturated solution of calcium carbonate in it, and what controls the deposition of the calcium carbonate is the concentration of carbon dioxide. So what happens is a tiny bit of carbon dioxide comes out of the thin water film, changes the chemistry of the solution, and that deposits calcium carbonate. And that produces a growing stalactite, and the water drips off the tip, just as it does for an icicle. The key difference, which is very important politically, I guess, is that these take about a graduate student lifetime to grow, maybe a little longer, and these take many graduate student lifetimes to grow, and are thus impractical to study in the laboratory. But we would like, in fact, if I could find a very patient graduate student, or perhaps a faster method of growing stalactites, my plan is to try and grow stalactites as well. So these two systems are examples of a very general class of things that we don't normally think of as one thing, which Ray Goldstein has decided to call precipitative pattern formation. And what we like to say about pattern formation is it's ubiquitous in nature. And it's very important to put on your low announcer voice when discussing ubiquitous in nature. And it really is ubiquitous in nature because it has the following paradigmatical process. You have some kind of surface, which is some shape. You let water or some other liquid, but almost always water, run over it. And something happens to change the shape, erosion, transport, deposition, dissolution, or in the case of icicles, growth. And that changes the shape slowly relative to the time it takes for the water to run over the surface. And that gives you a complex feedback between flow and shape. And it's this complex feedback which gives you the emergent pattern-forming structure. And it produces all kinds of interesting patterns in nature. So that complex feedback is active all over the place. So if you replace the water with a glacier, you can talk about this as a kind of glaciers carve out glacial valleys, how how streams carve out stream beds, how mountains are eroded and uplifted at the same time. All these things can be thought of as a kind of a class of systems where structures emerge from some kind of feedback between a flowing surface fluid, which is fast, and a slow driving force, a slow erosion or slow deposition, which is much slower. Okay, so icicles are just one class of thing, but of course they're also something that you can do in the laboratory very accurately, and so that's another reason why we're attracted to them, because this is a bit impractical to do in the laboratory, so we focus on something we can do. It's like looking where the light is, right, as physicists typically do. Icicles actually have three distinct modes of growth. You don't normally think of it, but there's actually three distinct ways. The most obvious one is that there's a drip of water hanging off the end, and in that drip of supercooled water, the ice grows into an almost bulk liquid. So there are little sort of needle crystals that grow, extend into the water drop, and they lose their heat either by the carrying off by the water falling off or by radiation and so on, as I'll tell you in a minute, out into the air, and that causes the icicle to get longer. But what's less obvious is the size of the tip is determined by the surface tension. It's determined by the size of that pendant drop, which can't be too much smaller than a few millimeters because of the surface tension, right? And so that actually leads to the tip of an icicle to be a little pipe, a little cone, a little opening. And there's actually a bunch of water which isn't frozen sticking up inside the icicle. If you were to take, if you're out looking at icicles and you have a bodkin, you can just pull your bodkin out and stick it up an icicle. And you'll discover that icicles actually are hollow for a considerable distance upward. And the reason you might say, well, why doesn't that water freeze in there? Well, the answer is that there's very little temperature gradient left there. That water is at 0 degrees in equilibrium with the surrounding ice, and there's just nowhere for the heat to go, so it doesn't go anywhere. Eventually, it freezes somewhere farther up when heat is removed through the root or some other way. And so that's mode one. So mode one tells you how fast the icicle is going to grow long. Mode two is the surface, thin surface fluid, thin surface flow. The heat gets out through that, and it causes the icicle to get fatter. And that's a different process because here the fluid film is extremely thin, less than a millimeter, usually less than a tenth of a millimeter thick. And then, of course, mode three is the much slower process by which the pipe freezes up and fills up the icicle. And this is actually not my model. This is actually the model of some glaciologists who worked on this before. Now, you might say, well, what are the differences between stalactites and icicles? The most important difference is that heat diffuses differently than carbon dioxide. So, for example, in caves, you often get a thing called a soda straw, and that's mode one only. So a little pipe begins to form, the water stays inside the pipe, and all it does is extend the pipe, but the CO2 cannot get out through the calcium carbonate that's been deposited, and so the thing never gets any thicker. It just gets longer and longer until it finally breaks off under its weight. So this is a cave with many, many soda straws, these very long things. Ice simply does not do this because the heat would get out and you would never get an icicle in the shape of a soda straw. But if water manages to plug, if it gets plugged and water runs down the outside, then you're back to the sort of morphology of an icicle and you get a stalactite which resembles an icicle in shape. And there are many other cave formations which are wonderfully complex things which have no analog in icicles. Which is a little difficult because it turns out in France, the word for an icicle is a stalactite du glace, an ice stalactite, okay? So when you're discussing stalactites versus icicles with French people, it's difficult because they use the same word for the two. In Quebec, the word for icicle is, glaçon, a glaçon, a little piece of ice. So that's the word that France French people use for the ice cube that you put in your drink, right? They need to talk about ice in drinks much more than they need to talk about ice hanging off buildings. So they have two words, but in Quebec they only use one. I discovered this while I was in the Côte d'Azur in the south of France, giving a talk about icicles on the beautiful, tropical, sunny, warm day at a Gordon conference. All right, so here is the star of the show. This is the icicle growing machine. Anyone who wishes to see this machine may drop by the fifth floor at any time. It's now covered with pink building foam. It was previously covered with blue building foam. This is the blue building foam. What it is it's about the size of a beer fridge. And we introduce water at the top, and we take the water out at the bottom, and we let the water dribble onto a rotating support. And there's three or four reasons for rotating the support. And the whole thing is refrigerated, of course. And we stir the air inside with little fans. I'll come back to that point. And we take pictures in time-lapse through the side of the box. This 1 second of this movie is 10 minutes of real time. The icicle grows very slowly. In real time, the experiment is like watching paint dry. It's very dull. It takes 4 minutes for the icicle to rotate. So you're watching it rotate, it's dull. The fans produce an airflow which replaces all of the air in the box every few seconds. So the airflow is much faster due to the fans than it is due to the rotation. So even though it looks like it's ripping around, it's actually going very slowly and boring. Now, the question is, why rotate it? Well, the first reason, I have to admit, is that it's just cool. It's just, I thought of it, I couldn't not do it. It's so cool. The other reason is more subtle, and that is the same reason as you rotate meat in your barbecue. You want all sides of it to be nicely cooked, and one of the theories we're trying to test is an axisymmetric theory of icicles, and it's quite difficult to make an axisymmetric icicle. So what we do is we rotate it slowly to stir out the anisotropies. The second reason, or maybe it's the third reason, is that we actually have an indexer that allows us to take a picture of the icicle actually 16 times per rotation, but we used 8 pictures per rotation. And we know exactly the angular position of the icicle every rotation and as a function of time. So we have complete three-dimensional space-time picture of the icicle as it grows. We detect the edge of the icicle 8 times per rotation. So that's every 30 seconds. The icicle takes maybe 8 hours to grow. And what was the last reason? Oh, yeah, the last reason is the nozzle is slightly off-center. So the nozzle drips in 0-degree water, but not at the center, a little bit to one side. And that guarantees that it sprinkles the water fairly and uniformly around the icicle. When you make all these steps, then you can grow nice, uniform-looking, axisymmetric icicles, as I'm showing you in this movie. If you don't do those things, then things go wrong, and you don't necessarily get an axisymmetric icicle. It circulates antifreeze. The temperature range from about -3 or -4 to about -17 degrees. Good old Canadian Tire brand antifreeze, okay? Okay, so I told you there's two distinct modes of growth, and they're quite different in the way they behave. The thing grows long and thin, the tip grows and the sides grow, but those have different growth mechanisms, and so they grow at different rates, and those rates depend in different ways on the temperature and so on. It's a bit like you might have a theory of why carrots. Why is a carrot long and thin? Well, the answer is very simple. The tip of the carrot grows faster than the sides do. And as long as they're in some relationship to each other, then the whole carrot will grow in a self-similar shape. And believe it or not, that's basically the theory of icicle shapes. All we need to do is figure out how the tip and the side grow and how those things scale. And the ratio of those two comes into the theory, as I'll show you in a moment. So here's some data. This is the length growth for various conditions of temperature and flow rate. So the basic parameters are the flow rate of the water, the composition of the water, the flow rate of the air, we usually use blowing air, the ambient temperature, and we also measure the humidity. We heat the funnel and we measure the drip-off water, the weight of the drip-off water. So basically we measure all the inputs and outputs. Everything you could measure, we measure. So here's the radius of the icicle growing actually it's the same set of conditions. So you see it barely changes its growth rate under these conditions, but the tip growth rate changes considerably. And some icicles, like this one in blue here, just suddenly stop dead. They stop growing in length very suddenly. And we call that cessation. In fact, when Antony wrote his thesis, we were told that cessate is not the right word. So we started using cease. Okay? So cessate, an icicle undergoes cessation, but it does not cessate. It ceases. So it gives you an idea how well written the thesis was. We had to split hairs like that. Anyway, so this is an icicle which is ceasing. So what happens is quite simple. You put in a low flow rate and use a rather low temperature, and you find that eventually all the water that you put in freezes before it gets to the tip, and it stops growing. And the interesting thing is it stops very suddenly. This tip grows at a constant speed, and then very suddenly it runs out of water and it stops. And so what we define as ceasing is when it stops before it leaves the bottom of our window here. So if, of course, some icicles would cease even longer than these ones do. But you see, it basically is a process at low flow rates and low temperatures, the thing is more likely to have stopped. Now, there is a theory of icicles, which is due to Ray Goldstein. And in fact, when Ray was here a few years ago giving talks for a certain job search that we were having at the time, you might recall that he gave a talk about the Platonic icicles. And they have this very, very pretty theory. They write down the physics of water flow and buoyant air flow. So the icicle is actually the warmest part of the environment. The icicle is at 0 degrees. All the rest of the environment is at like minus 10 or something. So there's a warm, buoyant plume of air blowing upward around all icicles. It's buoyant because it's warmer than the surroundings. And when you include the heat transfer through that buoyant air plume and how the thickness of the film depends on the angle that it makes with respect to the vertical and how the flow rate changes and all of that, you can write down a differential equation which completely scales out. There's no scales left in the equation. So rho is the dimensionless radius of the thing at a position which is a dimensionless z from the tip. And they're both scaled by this magic length parameter A. And when you do that, you get this differential equation which has this extremely non-obvious solution. And there are no scales left. So all icicles should converge onto this wonderful scaling shape, which is roughly a 3/4 power law. And they were very clever. They called that a Platonic icicle, which neatly insulates them from ever having to show one in nature. Because, of course, Platonic forms are not found in nature. They are just dreamed of, okay? But anyway, and they tested their theory by measuring 7 icicles found on the internet. And the reason they did that is they were in Arizona at the time, and there were no icicles. So I forgive them for that. But anyway, so there is a beautiful theory, or depending on how you feel things are beautiful, there is a theory of how the overall shape of an icicle should be. So our first job was to see if that actually worked at all. So we grew 200 icicles, more than 200, but 200 that were analyzable. And you realize each icicle takes an entire day to grow. And, you know, you got to take some weekends off, although not very many. And so this took a long time. So then you fit them using a single fit parameter A, which is like an empirical parameter. And you find, remarkably, that some of them fit. So there's something to the theory. If you take the best 5 chi-squares, the 5 icicles that are closest to the model, then they fit to an uncanny degree of accuracy. And this isn't just an accident, because there's only a single fit parameter here. For example, that slope up there is completely independent of that parameter. I can wave that parameter up and down, and this fit does not break. That's the good news if you're the theorist, okay? The bad news is that that's only the best 5. The other 95% are worse, and some of them are really bad. Okay, and so what we discovered very diplomatically when we wrote the paper was we said, you know, surprise, there exist at least some Platonic icicles, okay? But in fact, most icicles deviate from Platonic pretty severely. If you average over all icicles, then there's to some degree the theory is correct. But, you know, you start arguing about, you know, how big a chi-squared will you accept and so on. The most weird thing is that this parameter A is just some kind of wacky parameter. So it's the ratio of the growth, sort of a characteristic speed for the mode 2, the flat outside surfaces, versus the tip growth speed. And those things are scaled to the 4th power times this length, which is some length scale associated with the thickness of the air boundary layer. And it comes out this amazingly crazy combination. It has, you know, has temperature differences to the 5th and thermal conductivity of air to the 4th and all this crazy stuff in it. But the weird thing is, when you calculate it from the known values of these things, it turns out to be incredibly tiny. It's like microns. It's smaller than any other length scale in the problem. It doesn't make any sense. It's smaller than the capillary radius of the drop by a big margin. But when you fit the icicles, you find that when it fits, you get about the right order of magnitude for the lowest chi-squared. So something's going on, okay? It's not completely crazy. But it's an astronomically ridiculously small number. No one can really explain physically why it's so small. But the good news is that when you find a low chi-square, in other words, a good fitting, rather Platonic icicle, then lo and behold, that number really is the right order of magnitude, which is not, I can't explain it. It's magic, okay? The theory must have something going for it. That's the good news for the theorist. The bad news is this is a log scale, okay? And so some of them fit terrible, and they have huge chi-squares, and those ones depend on what the composition of the water is. So now you can say, well, I've shown you a Platonic icicle. show me the non-so-planktonic icicle. Well, here are two icicles made with under identical conditions, one of them with distilled water and the other one with Toronto tap water, okay? No laughing about Toronto tap water. I can tell you precisely what the composition of Toronto, I can tell you how much vanadium there is in Toronto tap water, because we sent samples of it over to the chemistry lab to be analyzed in detail. The long story, big long story short, is the icicles that are most planktonic are made of distilled water, and they have this nice, smooth, carrot sort of shape. The ones that are bumpy, and you'll notice they're ripply, and they're foggy, and they're quite complicated shapes, those ones are made out of tap water. Now, tap water and distilled water are, this one is dirtier than that one, but the difference isn't that big. The freezing point depression of tap water is in the millikelvin. It's maybe 50 millikelvin. So from the point of view of freezing and latent heat and thermal conductivity and all their usual properties, these things are practically identical. It's only the tiny little bit of impurities that makes this difference. Furthermore, the chi-square does not depend on the ambient temperature. It only really depends, the goodness of fit only really depends on the composition of the water and not on anything else. If you look at a cessating or an icicle which ceases, you find that the theory fits for a while until the icicle ceases, and then, not surprisingly, the icicle gets chubbier than it's supposed to be according to the theory, and the chi-square begins to climb. And as soon as it stops, the tip stops, then the icicle gets fatter up here than it should be given its length, and just as you would expect, the scaling theory breaks down. That's not too surprising. They actually did the theory by assuming that all the water ran down the icicle and none was consumed. Yeah?
What kind of water is closest to what falls out of the sky?
I will come to that. I have never grown an icicle out of water that fell out of the sky. I have only looked at water that has fallen out of the sky and ran over a roof. And those things, that turns out to be important. Okay, another thing that was a surprise. So when we started the experiment, I thought, oh, great, we'll use a closed box. We'll use still air in the box, and we'll use some fancy particle tracking, and we'll figure out the velocity of the air around the icicle and all that. Well, it turns out when you don't stir the air in the box, this happens. Multiple tips, what we call legs. And we don't understand why legs form when the air is not stirred. But it turns out that to make the most successful icicles, and the only ones you can really analyze, you must at least gently stir the air in the box. So we stir the air in the box. We do not know why we have to stir the air in the box. If we don't stir the air in the box, either for tap water or for distilled water, then a significant number of runs have this kind of craziness happen, and multiple tips all grow, and the icicle is a complicated shape. So another slightly thing that kind of gave us pause was my former student Jerome Neufeld. Some of you may remember him. He was an engineering science student here. He is now a geophysicist working at the University of Cambridge, so he's probably my most illustrious product, although he's not my PhD student, only my master's student. He and Goldstein et al. Worked on melting icicles, and they discovered a slightly strange thing, which is that if you look at the speed with which the icicle grows, V times the latent heat times the density, that is how much energy you must get rid of into the surrounding air. And you might say, well, it just conducts out through the air according to the air thermal conductivity and the gradient of the temperature. And that's called the Stefan condition. That would give you the rate at which the ice grows due to heat going out through the temperature gradient. Well, it turns out that evaporation of water into the surrounding air, which is not at 100% humidity, is the same size as the heat transport due to advection and diffusion. And radiation is the same size. So even though the icicle is only 10 or 15 degrees colder or warmer than the surroundings, the T to the fourth effect is quite significant. So it turns out that outside the icicle, you have turbulent advection, diffusion, radiation, and evaporation condensation all contributing to the heat transport. So in order to disentangle all these things, you have to be kind of subtle. It's not easy to write down equations for the heat transport outside of an icicle, especially if you stir the air. And they're all about the same size. And they discovered this in the process of doing a much easier experiment, which they called the ice lolly experiment. You make a cylinder of ice, and you put it in a box, you point a camera at it, and you wait. And it melts. And so it turns out that the heat transport is dominated by the flow of cold air off of the icicle, off of the ice, and that goes into the equations, and you can figure this sort of stuff out. So the other thing you may have noticed on the tap water icicles, which was not there on the distilled water icicles, which is also not present in the planktonic icicle theory, is the fact that many icicles are bumpy. Okay, they're ripply. And there's, in fact, another whole body of theorists in Japan, mostly, who have spent a large number of years and many papers trying to figure out why icicles are ripply. And in fact, the paper on icicle ripples, which Dylan Dearborn found for me in a very obscure Japanese language journal at Berkeley from 1938, is the first reference I know of where someone describes the ripples on the side of an icicle. Look, there are ripples on these icicles. They have a spacing of about a centimeter. And that's basically the whole paper. And it's in Japanese. But there's a figure. So we were able to figure out which paper it was by looking at the figures. So anyway, icicles develop ripples. And these are some pictures of ripply icicles. These two are mine. This one I pulled off the internet. Flickr has 5 billion pictures on it. So if you put in icicle ripples, you'll find many, many beautiful pictures of ripples. Pictures like this one, where you can see dozens of icicles and dozens of ripples. But for some reason, icicles refuse to remain flat, unlike the Platonic theory would suggest. And they develop a kind of bumpy structure. And that bumpy structure makes them look like the Michelin Man. And they always have a wavelength very close to 1 centimeter. So if you're in the woods and you lose your meter stick, you can simply break off the nearest icicle, and you'll have a perfectly good natural meter stick at your disposal. And I guarantee you that it will be calibrated, okay? That length, by the way, is independent of everything. We have never managed to break that. We don't know of any parameter that we can change that changes the wavelength of the ripples on the icicle. However, we did not observe ripples on distilled water icicles, so they seem to depend on the purity of the water. And the theory of icicle ripples is mostly due to Kazuto Ueno, and he basically does not take account the purity of the water. He just assumes pure water, and he blames the ripples on surface tension effects between the air and the water. Now, that's already a little fishy because a wavelength of 1 centimeter is very large compared to the characteristic lengths you would get from a capillary argument. You know, the drop at the end has a radius of a few millimeters, and at a length of a centimeter, the surface tension forces are very small, so it's already a little funny. And all these effects that I've been telling you about, surface tension, impurity, radiation, evaporation, condensation, all of them are left out of the Platonic icicle theory. So the Platonic icicle theory doesn't contain any of these things. I should mention that in addition to being rippled and looking like stalactites, looking like icicles, stalactites can also be rippled. So this is my hand in a cave near Budapest, and this looks wet, but it's actually just shiny. And lo and behold, stalactites also grow ripples sometimes. And those ripples also have a wavelength very close to 1 centimeter. Okay, so that's a clue that maybe it has something to do with the way the water flows over the surface, because that's the same for both icicles and stalactites. And ironically, there's a couple of Italian theorists who wrote a physical letter a couple of years ago in which they purport to calculate the wavelength of ripples on stalactites. But their theory cannot be generalized to icicles. It's crucially different than the theory of icicles. It's different than Ueno's theory, for example. Okay, so the first ripple experiment we did was a kind of mistake. Whoops. Is that going to start then? Yeah, there we are. It was kind of a mistake. The rotating thing wasn't working. We were debugging. And incidentally, the funnel froze. Okay, so we accidentally grew a stalagmite, which we didn't want to. But the good news was that it dripped down the surface of this thing, and it grew a very nice set of ripples that you can watch growing. And you can decide for me whether those ripples are moving or not. And this is a topographic picture of the ripples down one side of that ice finger. And you see this is a horizontal line. You see that the ripples are moving upward very slightly. Okay, no ice moves. What happens is that a new ice forms on the up side of the ripple very slightly more faster than it grows on the bottom side of the ripple. And so the ripple slowly climbs the slope. Okay, so that's actually good news for Ueno, because Ueno's theory predicts that ripples should move, and they should move up the icicle. There is another theory by Ogawa, another Japanese theorist, and he predicts that the ripples should move down. So you'll notice that there are exactly 2 theories of icicle ripples, and they differ in sign. And they exactly equal the number of theorists. Okay, so now we're ready to do the experimentum crucis, okay, the crucial experiment. We made scientific tap water. We started with distilled water, and we added back just enough sodium chloride to give it the same concentration of impurities as Toronto tap water. And then we added more in order to make it more and more impure. And the center picture here has the same level of saltiness as Toronto tap water. And by the way, this is Sigma Aldrich reagent grade sodium chloride. It's 9 nines pure, okay? No fooling around. We don't want anything but sodium chloride in there. And it takes only 40 milligrams per kilogram of salt. It's almost too small to weigh. It wouldn't even make your finger salty if you put it on there, 40 milligrams, okay? So of course we're making great huge volumes of this stuff, so it's actually pretty easy to make. But even at 40 milligrams per kilogram, you see the ripples are about the same as they are on tap water. And that makes sense, because this is just like tap water. If I take out those 40 milligrams, or I start with pure water, then I get an icicle which is not perfectly smooth, it's bumpy, it has air bubbles in it, they all have air bubbles in them, but those bumps never grow, and that we don't call those ripples, we call those bumps, okay? It's little distinctions like the difference between ripples and bumps that get you into trouble with referees, right? So a bump is a feature which you can measure, which does not grow, and is not part of a wave number, wave train, which does grow, and those things are called ripples, okay? That is what I demanded of the referee. Now, if you keep adding salt, you see that it gets bumpier and bumpier, and it actually gets quite distorted if you add enough salt. This amount of salt is actually still about 40 times less than that of seawater, so it's extremely unsalty by seawater standards. Until these experiments, no one had systematically looked at how icicles form as a function of salinity. They'd only looked at the seawater case. And they had noticed that seawater icicles are much different shape than distilled water icicles are, but that's about as far as it went. We are the first people to realize that it actually takes only a tiny bit of salt to change the morphology of the ice growth. Okay, so here's the experimentum crucis. These are all exactly the same. They grow at different rates. This one has nice ripples on it, and this one has bigger ripples, and this one has no ripples. It only has bumps. Okay, so here is the topography. So how do you measure the ripples? First of all, you take a very high-resolution photograph. Then you edge-detect it. Then you detrend it. Okay, so you take out the large-scale shape of the thing. And then you look in the Fourier bin, which is near the ripple wavelength of 1 centimeter, and you make a space-time image of that. And what you see is on a distilled water icicle, there is a little tiny bit of power left in the Fourier bin at 1 centimeter. And you see a low level of topography on there. If you then look at the tap water, the distilled water with this small fraction of sodium chloride, you see these patches of ripples appear. And it's sort of weird, but the ripples appear in little kind of wave packets. The wave packets actually move upward pretty fast, and the ripples move upward very slowly. So there's some kind of group velocity, phase velocity thing going on there, okay? And then if you look at the really bumpy one, you see the ripples grow to a saturated amplitude of about a millimeter or two, and they basically stop growing. They reach saturated amplitude pretty quickly, and they stick there for the rest of the growth. By the way, of course, these ripples down here are younger than these ripples up here because this is the tip motion, you see? So this ripple can't start until the tip gets to that height. Okay, so we can also animate. Remember, we have 8 different views of the same icicle. So this is an animation of 8 different rotational views of this icicle here. And this gives you an idea of how diverse the ripples are on a rather bumpy, rather ripply icicle. You see they have some complicated dynamics going on. They crash into each other. They split. Stuff happens, okay? So this is a kind of nonlinear ripple state. All right, so now we can examine how the ripples grow as a function of time. And if you take a distilled water icicle and you watch how the topography of it grows, it has measurable topography, it is bumpy, but that topography does not grow. This, by the way, corresponds to about 1/3 of a pixel in an 18 megapixel picture. If you put in a little tiny bit of salt, then sure enough, you can start to see the ripples grow, and they basically grow to something like a saturated amplitude. If you put in more salt, they grow faster, and they grow to a larger amplitude. Most of the error bars here that get bigger are due to the fact that the ripples become more likely to be different on each side of the icicle, and these are actually averages over rotation and time. And we also only study the top 10 centimeters of the icicle, which is about 10 wavelengths, because we want to study ripples that are all about the same age. If you go down to the bottom, then you have to be looking at ripples that are younger, at the top of the icicle that are older. Now, of course, this experiment was done in air. And everybody knows that water dissolves air. And everybody knows that when you make ice, it's all full of bubbles. So maybe the air's got something to do with it. Well, there's two possibilities. One would be to try to do the experiment without air, maybe on the space station. But no, doing an experiment without air involving water is ridiculous, okay? Because the water will simply evaporate. Also, you have to build a vacuum vessel, and I'm not going to do that. And you also, either that or you had to fill it with helium, and I couldn't afford the helium. So what we did was the next best thing. We took the distilled water, and we bubbled air through it for 24 hours to put as much air into it as we possibly could, super saturate it with air. And then we compared that with the stuff that we'd grown it out of before. And what we learned was, basically, it's already super saturated with air, and distilled water with air in it does not grow ripples by itself. So the white squares here are distilled water boiled with air bubbled through it. Well, Ueno claims that it has something to do with the surface tension. So what happens if we change the surface tension? So now we have a problem. If we add soap or anything, a surfactant, to the water to change the surface tension, we will also put ions into it. We'll make it dirty. So we had to find a surfactant that did not change the conductivity. And lo and behold, there is such a surfactant. It's called Triton X. And it has a strange property that it's non-ionic. You dissolve it in the water, and it does not release any potassium or sodium ions, and the water conductivity does not change. But its surface tension can be dropped by 50%. So if you grow an icicle with Triton X in the water, but no salt, what you find is that the ripples do not grow. Okay, so now we have this sort of existential problem. Are the ripples' wavelength different on this one and that one? Of course, there are no ripples. How can we talk about their wavelength? So the next thing you do is you start going a little crazy, and this is why PhDs take such a long time. You put in salt and sodium chloride and Triton X, and you begin looking at ripples because you put salt in to make the ripples and how the surface tension changes the ripples. And at that point, we started saying, whoa, stop. So we only did a few runs with both Triton X and salt in, and as far as we can tell, the surface tension makes no difference at all. Now, I may come back to you in a few years and tell you that that's not true because we have to do a whole bunch more experiments. But at the moment, experiments indicate that the wavelength is not dramatically different. Nothing is dramatically different when I change the surface tension by a factor of 2. Okay, so now the thesis gets really long, and you try everything, okay? So you try all different concentrations of salt and all sorts of different conditions, and you make a big data table. And this is what you find. The growth speed of the ripples is very, basically this is the topography of the bumps. This is 0 on a log scale, so you should immediately be suspicious. But I put this dotted line here to protect me against that claim. What you find is that the speed with which the ripples grow increases with the salinity, but only logarithmically. So this is a very tiny concentration. It's just barely enough to see the ripples. And this is like 1,000 times that concentration. And things get kind of gibbly up here because the ripples grow so fast and they get very nonlinear very quickly. But you see there's a trend, almost linear, roughly linear, but it's only logarithmic in the concentration. Why? Answer, we don't know. Even more strange, the wavelength of the ripples is very, very close to a centimeter, or the global average of 9 millimeters, independent of everything. So you can put in different flow rates, different salt concentrations by a factor of 100 or 1,000, and the ripple wavelength is always the same when there are ripples. This is the one I really like. If you put in a little bit of salt, you get ripples which climb the icicle, as I was telling you before, and furthermore, their climbing speed is almost independent of the concentration of salt until you get up to about 0.1 weight percent, and all of a sudden it begins to fall down, and then the ripples become, on average, downward traveling. So the traveling speed of the ripples actually crosses through 0 at a magic value of the salt concentration. Why does this happen? Answer, we do not know. Okay. It turns out that the evolution of ripples on cessating icicles, or ceasing ones, I should say, is complicated because they can sometimes grow and not saturate, but then turn around and get smaller again. And sometimes they grow to a smaller amplitude and get smaller again. And the reason for this is basically an icicle is not under constant conditions. It's growing in radius. We're putting in the same flow rate. That means the thin water film is getting thinner and thinner as it grows outward. And so all the dimensionless parameters change. And so the conditions of ripple growth change during the evolution of the icicle. And for some reason, they grow for a while in some icicles, and they smooth out. Now to answer the question that came up earlier, what does this have to do with natural icicles? Well, last March, I was fortunate enough to wake up in the morning and discover that there were icicles on my neighbor's garages. So I put on my coat, and I got a bag and a camera, and I skulked around my neighborhood stealing icicles off people's garages and putting them in Nalgene bottles, and I took them over to chemistry and analyzed them. And it turns out that a typical icicle growing on the side of a person's garage is actually cleaner than Toronto tap water. Now, probably it has bacteria and other stuff in it, but as far as dissolved salt goes, it's actually cleaner. But the key thing is that it's actually within the right range for the ripples on a natural icicle to be explained by their salt concentration. They are just dirty enough that we can see ripples on them, and those are the same kind of ripples as we see on laboratory icicles at the same salt concentration. Now, probably the ripples can be caused by other things in the water, and we're not measuring everything by measuring the conductivity, so there's more work to do on natural icicles here. But roughly speaking, if the water is run over a roof or something like that for a little while, it's dirty enough to be as dirty as tap water, and it will develop ripples for the same reason as we have ripples in our icicles. Well, let's talk about the theory. The ice is at something like 10 or 15 degrees different from the surrounding air. So the wall temperature in this experiment, let's say, is minus 12. The surface of the ice-water interface must be very close to the freezing temperature. And you might think, wow, this is an experiment that's driven by a huge temperature difference, 12 degrees. Well, it's not, because the thermal conductivity of the water is so low, it is so high compared to that of the air, that almost all the temperature difference is across the air. And almost all the temperature across the air falls across these thin boundary layers in the air. So about 10 degrees of those 12 degrees, or even more, falls through the air. And the actual temperature difference across the thin water film, if you assume it's in laminar flow like this and not been disturbed by ripples, is only in the millikelvin. It's only 50, 60 millikelvin. So the whole thing is actually driven by supercooled water, which is supercooled by less than a tenth of a degree. So the water that's flowing down the icicle is very slightly below zero. And that is the thing that drives the ice growth. And, you know, even though the icicle is growing a few centimeters an hour, that rate is consistent with that tiny little temperature gradient there. So the water is supercooled by a tiny amount. Now, the good news is that we know that if we add salt to water, the temperature, the equilibrium freezing temperature drops as you add salt, right? You put salt on your sidewalk to melt the ice for that reason. How much salt does it take to drop the temperature a significant amount? Well, the answer is hardly any. If you put in a concentration of just a few milligrams per kilogram, you can get a freezing point depression which is quite comparable to that 60 millikelvin. So the answer to the question of why is it so sensitive to the salt has something to do with the fact that the temperature gradient that's driving it is already only 50 millikelvin. I only have to drop the temperature freezing by 50 millikelvin to have an order one effect on that, right? So it only takes a tiny bit of salt to make that big a change. So now we have to try and do the theory. And it involves fluid mechanics. And if you've taken my fluid mechanics class, you know that there are only three problems in fluid mechanics. There are boundary conditions, boundary conditions, boundary conditions. We know exactly what the equations are for all the solid phase and liquid phases in this experiment. It's the boundary conditions that are difficult, okay? This, by the way, is von Karman. I attribute this quote to von Karman because he's much funnier than Prandtl. I made that joke in Göttingen, and nobody laughed. All right, so here is a kind of census. There are four fluid dynamical boundary conditions on the outside of the water film, on the surface. There are two conditions on the salt concentration which are linked to the growth rate. There's the Stefan condition, which I wrote down before. There's a condition on the freeze temperature, surface temperature, and its gradient. And there's a condition linking the salt concentration to the ice surface temperature. There are nine boundary conditions, okay? There are only two of them that are complicated. One is, what is the temperature of the ice water surface? It's the equilibrium temperature minus the concentration dependent drop in the temperature minus a rate dependent term. So this is the kinetic effect. The faster you grow the ice, the colder it gets. This is normally neglected. It's very small. But it's millikelvin, so it's order one. And then there's a complicated boundary condition which you have to put on the heat flow away from the icicle through the surrounding air. When you put all that together and you write down three fields, the stream function, the temperature, and the concentration of salt, and you do everything you can do to solve that perturbatively, in other words, you put on an infinitely small ripple on the icicle, and you ask, how does that change the fluid flow? The first thing you find is that it produces what's called a secondary flow like this, and that causes a deformation of the free surface. This is the ice surface. That's the free surface. This is vertical direction, and this is the thickness of the thin water film that's running down multiplied by 100. Okay, so it's much thicker than it actually is, probably 100. Okay, so wherever there's a bump here, the ion is producing heat, and the heat is conducted, so the temperature's a little warmer there, a little more salt is produced, and it's flowing. It's being advected by the water downstream. And so you put all this together, and you try to calculate whether that deformation of the surface that you assumed in the first place is growing or shrinking, okay? The Stefan condition tells you whether it should grow or shrink. You put all this together, and the theory completely fails. Why? It fails because it predicts that infinitely small wavelength ripples will grow infinitely fast. So it has a kind of ultraviolet catastrophe. So there's something missing in the physics here, something that cuts off the small wavelength growth. Interestingly, this problem does not occur for stalactites. And the theory that was published for stalactites does not have this problem. Why, again, I don't know. The answer almost certainly has to do with something that I haven't mentioned at all, which is the fact that ice is not a simple homogeneous material. It is crystalline, of course, polycrystalline even. So people have sectioned icicles. This is a beautiful picture from an old Scientific American article. If you put them between cross polarizers, you can see the beautiful crystal structure of the ice. And in between all these grain boundaries and so on, there can be liquid water. And it turns out if you grow ice from supercooled water at the microscale, it is unstable to growing dendrites. So if you look very closely at this ice, it is not a flat surface. It's actually a forest of little dendrites. And there's a length scale associated with those dendrites, which is related to the surface tension between the water and the ice. And that gives you a wavelength in microns. So on the micron scale, these things are kind of little forests. And as they grow, these little channels here get filled with water, which is almost exactly at equilibrium with the surrounding ice, and it gets trapped in there. And so you get what's called spongy ice or mushy ice. And of course, if you add impurities to this, the impurities themselves get trapped in those little pores. And the whole thing becomes a complex material, which is partly water and partly slightly salty water and partly ice, okay? And we have the world's expert at spongy ice here, Roland List. And so after all these years, we started to look up papers from, you know, the 60s and 70s, and we're discovering that all these things were known to people who study hailstones and stuff like that before, but it was not realized by the theorist who worked on icicles that it turns out to be crucial. It cuts off somehow, we don't know how, it cuts off the growth of infinitely small ripples. Another way to put it is the ripples are an instability not on an ice surface, but on a surface which is already unstable at the microscale to dendritic growth. Okay, we can't see the dendrites because they're so small. This is a micron here. Okay, this is called the Mullins-Sekirka instability. So this is kind of the bleeding edge of icicle physics now, is we need to understand this growing surface not as a smooth boundary, but as some kind of fuzzy boundary, and take account of the fact that the ice is actually spongy. Up to a quarter of the water in the icicle is not frozen. It's still liquid. That's a surprise to us, but it turns out that that's true for lots of situations where ice is being grown from supercooled water. Okay, well, I've reached the conclusions. Notice that I'm exactly on time. Pure water icicles can be close to the Platonic theory, but they can also deviate from the Platonic theory in interesting ways. And just as it's true of all Platonic things, the deviations are probably just as interesting as the ideal. Ripples are probably due to something to do with the ionic impurities, and they're not directly, at least, due to the surface tension effects, as Ueno's theory has it. And we really don't have a fully worked out theory of all of this. And I'd like to say the real hero of this story is Anthony Chen, who worked for something like 6 years to make the data that I showed you today. Thank you very much for your attention.